Sonny Osborne's going to call in again for what we've taken to call Saturdays with Sonny. Today, as a jumping off point, we're going to talk about life on the road. As you may know, Sonny started life on the road as a musician at about the age of, 13 or 14. And he's got some stories to tell. We're going to talk about what it is to be on the road, not just the stories that result as a consequence of being there. But please stick around. On the phone right now, let me get the phone up here, is Sonny Osborne. How you doing, Sonny?
Hey, brother. Did you say Seldom Seen and Darling Corey?
Seldom Seen and Darling Corey. That's what I was playing when we were waiting to come on.
Is that the Wake Up, Darling Corey?
Yeah.
Or Copeland's Gone?
Yeah.
Which one?
It's Darling Corey. It was basically Dig a Hole.
Oh, my God.
If you think of that, Dig a Hole, that's the best way to describe which one this was. But just a real slow... yeah, I did.
And you played Seldom Seen versions of the Flat Scruggs.
Well, and, you know, I've been on here for a couple hours now. I played all kinds of Flat and Scruggs, and I just had this strung out. You know, I put like 65 songs on here just to make sure I got enough to play, and I was just clicking around waiting for phone calls, and that came up on the shelf. I've already played for you. If you're telling me you're not listening, then you're just not picking up on what's happening here, man.
I hear you. Not only is your name Steve Martin.
I mix it up, man. You'd have tuned in at 2. You'd have heard Osborne Brothers. You'd have heard all kinds of Flat and Scruggs. You'd have heard Monroe. I started off with about 10 or 12 of Right Down the Pike, and I just kind of mix it up as I go, you know.
Well, that's what they
do. Well, people like it. People like different stuff, and there's so much under that big umbrella that's called bluegrass, you know, even, you know, I kind of keep it real, even though the show is unreal, and then we have you call in to make it, take it that much more out into the, you know, to the real zone or the unreal zone, whichever way you're thinking at the time. I do appreciate you calling in, though. I'm enjoying this, and people look forward to it. People tune in to hear it, and word's starting to get out that the Chief can be available at 4 o'clock on a Saturday, and they want to know what you're thinking and what you're saying.
Okay. I talked to Carrie Panties in California, and I think that she sent me a picture that you used to promo this show.
Yes, yes, and your check is in the mail.
And she took that picture.
Yes, she did. It's beautiful.
Yeah, okay, all right. As long as I know that you're not trying to speak to Ogo or something.
No. She, you know, I have that picture hanging on my wall here because after that, when she took it, she sent me one in the mail because I asked her. And then a couple weeks ago, she sent me one, that same photograph. She put the words on it. She said, here, use this. So I throw that up on Facebook on about Thursday coming up to the show so people know. It's called Saturdays with Sonny.
She's a good photographer. She comes to Venture Camp every year and takes some great pictures.
Sonny, I can stand right next to her with the camera and look at the same thing, and we take a picture of the same thing, and we both have cameras. That are not that far off, and hers is a whole different ballgame. She has the eye for it, and you're talking about Carrie Antes out, and I believe she's out in Southern California. Just a nice person, and boy, she's got a great touch with the camera.
I think she's around San Francisco, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, I once I get out past the Mississippi, it's all out west to me, so.
Thanks to you. Yeah. I think so, too.
Yeah.
Anyway, when you're out there, it doesn't matter who you are, when you look east, you see that stupid mountain out there and know that you've got to go across that again before you can get home.
Get back. I know. Well, yes. Yes. And you know that bit more than everyone. You know what? That's a nice segue. You're actually good at this. We were going to talk today about being on the road, and you're talking now about traveling around and getting across the Rocky Mountains. Some people want to know what it was like for Sonny Osborne and the Osborne Brothers, or maybe just bluegrass in general, back, you know, starting back when you did, and life on the road is kind of a general topic, and I know you got a lot to talk about, but you started really young doing this on the road.
Oh, yeah. Well, this may take a while.
We can do the Reader's Digest version in about 45 minutes or so.
In the early days, you traveled in a car. I'm talking about a time where most of people who hear this probably won't even know about. But I'm talking the time where you had blowouts and flat tires as you drove. You used like nylon tires, a little radial, and you had to put brakes on the car about every 10 or 15,000 miles.
Wow.
The tires would last 10 or 15,000 miles at best. And you're only in a car, and if you had a bass player, you put the bass on top of the car on a rack. And this is before electric bass players got into bluegrass music. And if it rained, that cover that they had on the bass back in those days, it didn't leak. And if that, but the cover would just get really so. I'll tell you a funny story about this. We were in Toledo one time with Homer and Chesto. And Homer Haynes was one of the funniest, quiet guys. He was just really quiet, would just stand around and not say much, but when he said something, it could be really funny. So Cedric Rainwater was playing the bass for Johnny and Jack at that time. And Homer and I were standing right beside the door coming in from outside, and it had stormed the night before. I mean bad, rain hard. And Johnny and Jack were on the way from someplace to Toledo to play that show. Well, Homer and I were standing there, and Cedric had gone out the car and took the cover off the bass, and it was just literally soaked. And he was carrying it like his arms were out in front of him, like you would carry a piece of wood or something like that. His arms were out in front of him, and that case, that thing was on his arms. as he walked through the door, Homer and Cedric was already mad because his face cover was just so, and he didn't acknowledge anybody, and he got about 10 feet past us, and Homer looked around and said, "Hey, buddy." And Cedric turned around and looked at him, and Homer said, "He lost your face." Cedric gave him one of those two-word passes, and just turned around and walked forward. Anyway, get back on subject again.
No, that's the subject. That's what I want to hear about.
Well, it was just a funny thing. Back way back in those days where you traveled in a car, or if you were doing quite well, you traveled in a limousine, and I think Bill Monroe was the first guy to have a bus in Nashville. And then Professor Earl had one in the early 50s. They had a bus they traveled in. Before that, if you were lucky enough and could afford it, you would buy a limousine car and travel in that. I did that when I was 15 years old, and playing with Bill Monroe, we traveled in a 53 Cadillac limousine. And it was powder blue, beautiful, beautiful car. But in those days, the air conditioning was just a new thing that had just started out. And the compressor and all that stuff was in the trunk. And it had vents, plastic, clear plastic pipes that ran up over the rear windows and up to the front. And there was openings in that plastic. And there were scoops between the back door and the trunk. There were scoops that caught the air or the compressor to compress and make into cold air. Well, when it would get really, really hot, that cold air would be all right in the back for the passengers was, but then in the front were me and Jimmy Martin and Charlie Klein were riding, three in the front seat and Jill and Bessie had the whole back seat by themselves, and the jump seats back there and the whole thing. They had that whole thing, and it was nice and comfortable back there. Well, up there in front was just unbearably hot, and we couldn't put the windows down, and we were just trapped up there, and it was really, really not comfortable. But before that even, you had just a regular car, and sometimes, if you didn't have a good cover like Cedric had, I told you, Marjorie, he had a good cover, but if you didn't have a good cover, you had to put the face inside the car, and the face would be the back end of the foot on the bottom of it would be in the back window, but they would, of course, take it out or collapse it and shove the face up there on the back shelf in the back window, and then the neck would be across the seat, the front seat. And whoever was riding in the back, if you were on the passenger side of the car, you had your head over to the right, and if you were on the driver's side of the car, your head would be leaned over to the left to make room for that face. And you slept just as little as was possible. And in those days, it just wasn't very much at all. And one of the bad parts of being on the road, you plan the Opry here on Saturday night and going to, let's say, Sunset Park in Westville, Pennsylvania for a 3 o'clock show the next day. And if you did the 6:30 show here at the Opry and then drove like an absolute maniac, you'd make about 15 minutes before you went on, you would make it to Sunset Park. Well, that meant that you had to change clothes in the car. We didn't go on stage in blue jeans and dirty shirts and stuff like that. We changed into dress pants and at least a clean shirt. And we always wore a tie with a white shirt and all that stuff. But you changed in the car on the way there, so that when you got there, you would already be changed. You wouldn't have to take time to go to the bathroom out there and change clothes and go back, because you would do only 3 o'clock. Well, you get there about 15 or 20 minutes before 3, just time enough to get the instruments out and tune up, and then you're on. And the way they did the thing at Sunset Park, if you weren't on, they would dock you. And so it was imperative that you go on at 3 o'clock, or you would lose money in the process. So, but that's just one thing. And there's no interstate. The first time I think that I rode on an interstate was the Pennsylvania Turnpike. And I had heard about it, and it was with Monroe. I'd heard about the Turnpike and that it, they charged you and all like that. Well, I didn't know anything about that. 14 years old, what did I know? So I marveled at that when we got on that thing and could drive. Well, there was two lanes on over here going east, and two lanes going west, and you were away from that other side. I thought, my gosh, this is the way it has to be right here. Well, and then I don't know if you know this or not, but Eisenhower is the guy that instigated the interstate highway system. Yeah. You know that?
Yes, sir.
He did. Yeah. Dwight Eisenhower. And I don't know if it's still the same or not, but back then you couldn't have an area, I think it was 40 or 50 miles in length, that there wasn't at least a mile of straight. That's the straight highway. So if an airplane got in trouble, they could land on that. That in the beginning, that was the way they built the system. Now, whether they do it that way now or not, I don't know.
I've never heard of that.
Oh, yeah. And it happened several times. Minnie Pearl's husband, Henry Cannon, used to, if we'd be on the road, like, we'll Bill Monroe, the Bluegrass Boys, okay? if we'd be on the road playing in Raleigh, North Carolina, and at that time you had to play the Opry on Saturday to be a member. You had to be there on Saturday. And then, that's the rules, that's the way it was. And the Opry was so important to your career that, like, if we were to play Raleigh, North Carolina, or Boston, or New York City, someplace like that far off, Bill would leave us in a hotel on Saturday night, and he would hire Henry Cannon, which was Minnie Pearl's husband, to bring his airplane to where Bill was and fly him back to Nashville. And he'd do the office with a makeup band of some sort and then fly him back the next day to where we were, and then we worked that next week. Well, I think two or three times Henry had to land his plane on the interstate.
Wow.
And I know that for a fact. He had to do that. Once was, I think, in Knoxville. If I'm not mistaken, I've been a long time. That's been, good gracious, 60 years ago. But he had to land his plane on the interstate of the crash. And so that was the reason that rule or that law was in, that they had to build at least a mile straight. And so a plane could land on it. Anyway.
It'd be hard to do today with all the cars. Of course, back then there weren't that many cars traveling, but man, oh man.
I know. But I got to, while I was telling that about the mile straight in the line I got to think, can you imagine a 747? Sitting down in that mile. The weight stand on that thing would take out housing development. I just thinking about this. That'd be funny.
Well, now every time from here on out, when I'm driving on the interstate and there's a mile stretch, it's flat and straight, I'm going to be looking up in the sky.
Yeah, well, that's the reason that it's like that, or that it was back then. I don't know if they still have that in effect, or I have no idea, none whatsoever. But there's another thing about, like, if you played Sunset Park and were here in Nashville and did the 6:30 show on Saturday night, and drove like a maniac, well, your fans, the people that liked you, that you would draw, they would hear a couple of weeks before that, oh my gosh, Bill Minogue and the Bluegrass Boys are Flat and Scruggs, or the Stanley Brothers, they're going to be here this coming Sunday, man. We're going to go see them. So they're all fresh and they've eaten, and I mean, they're all feeling good. They just can't wait for you to get there. Well, the people, that they don't realize that you feel like a bumblebee is going off in your head, and you're so tired you just barely can hold your eyes open, and you spar off at some guy, and he's thinking, well, that's, you know, what? Why can he be so rude? Well, you forget that guy hadn't eaten anything in probably 14 or 15 hours and hasn't slept over 20 minutes in the last day and a half.
Wow.
And it's an unfair situation, but no, neither side can help it one way or the other. And I can understand how people would think, oh boy, they're coming, I'm going to go see them and all like that. And you got good friends, you know, that live in some cities. I've got friends, close friends, best friends in Knoxville, Tennessee. But he understands that. Jim Smith's his name, and he plays Malin, used to be for the Pinnacle Boys.
Hmm.
But he understands that and puts up with it, you know. I understand how you feel, you know, and all like that. But most people, like, okay, I've got the friend, let's say, in Tallahassee, Florida, or Jacksonville, or New Orleans, or Dallas, and good friends, you know, that you go out and have dinner with, or just hang around with, and they don't realize that when you get there, that you're almost just barely, barely able to motivate, and they've had they have lost 2 or 3 hours sleep in the last month. Hmm. So it's just a bad situation. I hope I explained that right.
No, you did. And then I think, I don't know what to compare it to as far as how some of the bands travel today. They all seem to have, well, if they have any success, notable success, they seem to have pretty nice buses, but you're not talking about that those days back in that time, are you?
No, Lord, no. Just the best country thing that had buses in the 50s. I remember we worked with Hank Thompson. He had a big band, and they had a bus that traveled in. Hank Snow traveled in a gold and blue limousine Cadillac. Johnny and Jack traveled in a Cadillac limousine. Monroe had that light blue. Ray Price had two guys working with him. Was the Don Hills was one, and I can't remember the other guy. Had two guys, and they traveled in just a regular car. Ray Price, this was in 53. They traveled in just a regular car. The Stanley Brothers, I don't think Cameron had anything other than a car to travel in. Lester and Earl had, they were in cars, and then they got that a limousine when they got the Martha White sponsorship. They had a, I think it was a 52 or 53 Cadillac limousine, white, and then they bought a bus shortly after that. I think it was a 49 GMC or something. I can't remember what it was now. Blue. You probably, there's an album with a picture of that bus on it.
Yeah.
I think that bus was blue and white, I believe. And did you, I'll tell you an interesting little side note here. At the station end, right now, as you go in the door and you pay to get in and all like that, you go in the door and turn right, and then you pay so-and-so or whoever's there to get in, and then you walk straight ahead and turn left to get into the room. Well, straight ahead of you is a row of bus seats sitting up against the wall.
Oh, yeah, the back wall. The back wall, yeah, sure.
You've seen them, haven't you?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Okay, those seats came out of Lester Earl's old blue and white bus.
I didn't even know they were bus seats. I just thought they were taking use, yeah. But I didn't know they came out of that bus either.
Oh, they came out of Lester Earl's bus, that old blue and white bus they had. Yeah. So, anyway, next time you go on the station, they use that Lester Earl's old bus seat.
Well, how long before the Osmond Brothers had a bus at some point, but you had a lot of miles to get there?
Goodness gracious. We traveled in a, I know in, we had a 51 limousine Cadillac in, oh my gosh, 56, 57, something like that. And then we got a 59 Fleetwood Cadillac that we drove 270 or 80,000 miles. Great car, a wonderful car. And then after that, we had a 63 Fleetwood Cadillac that we drove. So we used Cadillacs everywhere there because their engines were so good. And you had no problem out of their engines. And those cars were built better than Chevrolet or Ford back in those days. Now they're not like that now. But their engines were just good, and you could sit and drive more than 85 miles an hour all day long, and it would not heat up or anything like that. You couldn't do with the cars that way. The last car that we had was a 65, I think, Cadillac, I believe it was. Yeah, 65. And then we bought a Norris motorhome and used it for, that was probably 67. We used it for a little while, and then we had Norris build us a special one, a bigger, more roomy, and a place with the equipment and all that stuff. In 1970, we had that built. And then we used motorhomes because if you use a bus with that diesel engine in it, when that diesel tore up, which it did a lot because nobody bought a new bus, you got one with 200,000 or 300,000 miles or 1,000,000 miles on it, the bus company had used to go back and forth from one place to another. And when the engine, something would happen to it, of which it invariably did, but when something would happen to it, you not only had to find a diesel mechanic, but you had to find a good diesel mechanic that knew what he was doing. And it was so hard to do, and things happened to an old engine like that. And so we always used stuff with a gas engine in it where you could take it to a Dodge dealership or Chevrolet or something like that, and they knew how to work on it. Well, I think we had a 76, 78. The last motorhome that we had was a 1978 sports coach. And we bought it in Durham, North Carolina. And from a guy named Buddy Gregg, I think it was, and he's in Knoxville now. Well, I think he's dead, but I think his son runs a place in Knoxville now. But anyway, that was the last motorhome we had. It was a 78. And then we bought an Eagle bus. I think that must have been 81. I think maybe 1981 or 82. And the reason we bought the bus was Bobby had heart bypass surgery. And a motorhome, they were really good and all like that. And the motorhomes we had were just wonderful. But they didn't mind. They bounced a lot. And he had that heart surgery. And we were kind of thinking about it anyway. And I'll get back to this in a minute.
Okay.
About thinking about buying something else. But anyway, we bought that bus and put Bobby's bedroom midway in the bus so it would ride better, and it would be more comfortable for him. And we kept that bus until we kept it 23 years.
Wow.
That's for sure. It was a funny thing. At one point, I got looking at Conway Twitty and those guys. They would be playing, let's say, Topeka, Kansas. Well, they'd come into the airport, and their pilot would land the plane. They'd get off of it, all of them refreshed and good and all that. And I got to thinking, I told Bobby, I said, you know what? We could probably buy a twin-engine airplane and get somebody to pilot it and take care of it, and we wouldn't be out too much more money. So we started looking around for an airplane. Well, there was this guy in Indiana that he knew where there was a twin engine that only had, but I don't remember how many hours, but it was really a good airplane, although it was 4, 5, 6 years old. And we could have gotten it for less than what we got that bus for. So we were discussing that, and my wife and I and the two children were sitting at the dinner table one evening, and I broke that news to her. She just very calm and just looked up and said, "You pay attention to all that sits around you here, this house, your family, cars, everything that's here. You can go ahead and buy the airplane and be good. But the day you do that, all the bits will be gone."
Well, I made your choices, narrowed your choices down, didn't you?
It didn't leave any choice at all. And I never get to that airplane again. But I take it that the same thing happened to Bobby's house, but we never mentioned that airplane again after that. That was the last mention of an airplane. Oh, my gosh, that was probably 1980, let's see, yeah, maybe 1978 or 79, 80, right in there, just before we bought that bus. It was funny, I swear it was. He said, all of this will be gone. And I'm thinking, you know, that could happen. That surely could happen. So we didn't mess with airplanes.
Well,
and after that, I think, I can't remember who I saw. Conway, I guess it was Conway Twitty. I remember the date. It was either Philadelphia or Richmond, Virginia, we were playing. I think Richmond, it's a mosque. I believe it's at Richmond, Virginia. And I'm standing with my manager 10 minutes from going on the stage, just standing backstage, thinking and trying to solve the world's problems and all, you know, all that stuff.
Sure.
I hear this voice that says, "How you doing?" I looked around, it was Conway. And he said, "I understand that you guys are thinking about buying an airplane." And I said, "Well, we had discussed it." Yeah, now this was before she broke the news. And I said, we discussed it. And Conway just shook his head. He said, "You don't want to do that." That was all. That was all it said. And I didn't know what he was talking about. But he had trouble with his plane, and I think he got rid of it or sold it or something like that.
Well, you
so
know,
Bobby's son's got an airplane, and he's had one for 25 years, I guess. Had no problem at all with it or anything like that.
Does Bobby travel by plane now?
No. So, got that bus I think he travels in. Not the old bus that we had. That thing's been chopped up and sold for parts years ago.
Did you drive the bus?
Oh, I drove the bus. And I was going to mention another thing. It talks about eating right and exercising and all that stuff.
Yeah, that was
the
we talked about that before we went on the air, but that was a question someone had is back in the day. What did you guys do to eat right and exercise and stay fit? So that's what you're talking about now. Go ahead.
That came into effect. What you learned to do was, and I drove the bus because I didn't trust anybody else until Raymond Huffmaster came along. But anyway, I drove the bus. And how you learn how to eat, it's different because you learn how to eat and drive at the same time. And I could do that. I could eat almost anything and drive at the same time. And that was just what you ate properly. And then exercise would be, and see, our bus didn't have power steering on it until, 3 or 4 years before we got rid of it, and we had power steering put on it, but it didn't have power steering, so that was the exercise that you got by turning that steering wheel, and it was no easy thing to do. I mean, I had an ankle bunch of shoulders built up and biceps. I was in real shape, but it didn't come from lifting weights. It came from that steering wheel.
Well, maybe you ought to think about, you know, now that you've got time to go back, maybe do an exercise DVD and call it, you know, the bus driver's Keep Fit DVD.
That'd be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
That would really be.
It's marketing, man. It's marketing.
One of the Isaacs, I can't remember which one it was, we were at the Opry House one night, and this was while I was still working and drafting and all that stuff, and it's either one of the girls or Ben hit me on the shoulder, and my arm was just like a rocket. He says, "My gosh, somebody's been working out." I thought, "Yeah, working out all night." Trying to fit old book. I tell you, one time we were in Charlotte, no, Greensboro, North Carolina. and I'm going along about probably 70 miles an hour in the right lane, and all of a sudden, it's like a shotgun went off. Pow! Like that. And that bus just took to the right real hard, and I thought, oh my God, blow out on the front.
Hmm.
And I'm trying to hold that bus back in the road, and you got 30-some thousand pounds up there saying, no, I'm going to go this way. And you're trying to force it to go against that with that tire. And man, I stood up, and I was strong back then. I stood up and put everything I had behind that steering wheel to hold it in the road. We'd have wrecked for sure. We'd have turned over.
Hmm.
But it didn't. And
What was the sound? Was it a blowout?
The only yell was the whole car flew into. Not real. Another thing, in those old buses, our bus was all that old when we bought it, but the thing of it is, it was an old-style bus compared to what they have nowadays. Then they have power steering, automatic transmission, you name it. Built-in GPS, telephone system, all that stuff that these buses nowadays. And you don't have to be anything to drive one of them. I mean, you can just, but it wasn't sold back in those old buses because they had standard transmission, four-speed transmission, or a five in some cases. Ours had four. And it was a job to drive those things. I mean, it really was. It was not easy to do that. And with that diesel engine, we had a V8, 871, I think, was the engine that we had at ours. And if you ran out of fuel, which was easy to do because I never saw one with a fuel gauge on those old buses. I never saw one with a fuel gauge that worked right anyway. And it was not a big thing for you to run out of fuel. Well, there were two fuel filters on that engine. And when you ran out of fuel, you had to take the filter off and fill it with fuel and put it back on. And all this time, you're getting diesel fuel all over you. And you put the filter back on and start it, and it would pick the fuel up and run until it would get down and that fuel pump would pick it up. So it would quit. You take that filter off again and fill it back up. I spent 2 to 3 hours and done that right there before it started again.
Wow.
Really. The clutch went out one time. We were on the way to Withlacoochee, Florida, and along about Macon, south of Macon, Georgia. Dan Cook pulled me up. He said, I think the clutch is gone.
Mm.
And sure thing, the clutch was gone. Well, if you know how that engine and transmission works, it's possible, and it's not a really big thing, but it's just not a normal thing. It's possible to drive that bus without a clutch. I mean, you can do that.
Mm.
If you know how the engine sounds when you change and all that. And so I drove that bus about, 60 miles or 70, 80 miles south of Macon to Withlacoochee, Florida. And when if you had to put it in reverse, you'd have to turn the engine off and put it in reverse and then start it again. And as you started, the bus would go, you know. You know what I mean by that?
Yeah, yeah.
When you push on the starter, it would go, well, that's how you back up. And I drove it from there to Withlacoochee and then all the way back to Nashville without a clutch. And you talk about a tired human being. By the time I got back to Nashville, here in Nashville, I was super tired, I'm telling you, real, really tired. And my right foot was operating, you know, from operating that accelerator because you have to mess with it to get that thing in gear. I was really tired. And I don't know if You probably don't know about Mont Eagle Mountain.
No.
But Mont Eagle is about, oh, I don't know, 100 miles south of Nashville, maybe not 100, pretty close to it, though, south of Nashville. And coming up this side over here going south is not too bad, but coming north is really steep and long. And that was a real job, that bus, over that mount, without a clutch. It was just, but that was one of the fun things to do.
Wow.
Oh,
you miss it, don't you? I can tell by the sound of your voice you miss it.
Oh, I miss it terrible. you just have no idea. The last 2 years, I guess, and we kept the bus at a place in Gallatin, Tennessee, and we always met at this hotel here in town in Hendersonville and loaded up, and we left from here. Well, and the guys left the hotel parking lot, which we cleared from them, and it's okay. But about the last 2 years, I would go up there to Gallatin. It was my job to go up there and get the bus and bring it back down. And when I would turn the corner into that parking lot to see that bus there, I always got sick. I mean, it was almost like a vomit sick. Every time I looked at that thing, it really did. I was, when I quit, I was flat out ready to quit. I really had gotten, I'd answered all the questions I knew how to answer, and about a million times, I would say. And it just, I got put out completely. I love the banjo and all my stuff. I still love to listen to one if it's played right, played good. Kenny Ingram and Aaron McDaniels, Rob McCurry, just a few, Kristen Benson, and Ron Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
Those people can flat out play. And like Jens Kruger, but he's so far above my head, I can't really enjoy what he's done, but he's an absolute mastermind when it comes to the banjo. I love to hear the banjo when it's played by Bill Emerson.
Mm-hmm.
Tony Trischka, I love to hear him play. Alan Mundy, I love to hear him play. Because most of these guys, they also know how to play the traditional style of banjo, and they do it correctly. And some of the guys, the melodic players, when they play like traditional style banjo, they don't play it very well because they don't learn that to begin with. And it's an acquired taste that you have to know what you're doing. And but I love the banjo, but well, I'm telling you, I got so burnt out on it, you couldn't believe. You just couldn't believe. And I thoroughly enjoy now building banjos, the chief banjo.
Yeah.
It keeps me involved in it a little bit. I don't ever go anywhere as far as going to a show or anything like that because that involves getting dressed and shaving, of which I'm not crazy about that either.
Well, that's a chore. That's a chore.
My banjo camp. I enjoy my banjo camp because I've got a whole lot of friends that come there that I've been knowing now for 10 or 11 years as long as we've been doing that. And I enjoy talking to them and seeing them and listening to people play and things like that. But as far as playing myself, I haven't even tried to play the banjo in, oh my gosh, 10 years. I had the shoulder surgery in 2003, and that wound my playing up. And I was really ready to quit. I really was. When it becomes a job and not fun anymore, you should hang it up. And it had become a job, a hard job to me.
Well, you did it all. I mean, you know, you did it all. You lived it from the beginning. You know, what else were you supposed to do? You did it all. You made your mark, which is huge, and you don't like to acknowledge that. But you cut a path that's much, much bigger than you'll ever acknowledge personally.
Well, I don't want to, you know, because you know what?
I'm saying it for you.
Listen to me. I hate conceit. I detest conceit. And when you think to yourself, man, I was really good, I'm really good, and all that, that's conceit on my part, on the way I look at it. And I know what I did. I know what I could do. But there wasn't anybody there to impress, and that sounds conceited too. But I just don't like conceit in any way. I did what I was supposed to do, and I did it as well as I could. I'll put it that way.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, knowing how you are, I just need to say every once in a while to people listening that they recognize it. They're never going to hear it from you, so I have to say it for you. So there, I just did.
Well, I appreciate it. I really appreciate that. I appreciate it. Everybody for thinking that, and do you know what time it is?
It's almost time.
do you know where your kids are?
Yeah, I do know where she's at, but she's driving, so I'm okay with that. But I do need to check out of here, but I've enjoyed it.
Yep.
You know, we're going to get out of here. That's right about 5 o'clock, and that's when they start tapping their fingers, wondering, I'm going to shut this thing down. So we'll do it again. This was great. I enjoyed it. People love hearing what you did and all that stuff. It's a good time.
As long as you enjoy it and thank you for the clip, I'll answer them.
I know. Well, we'll always have something to talk about. So you take care of yourself, and then we'll think about some other stuff for next week. And people send me questions. That's where one of the questions came from. People send me questions on email about asking about this and asking about this, and they all listen to you. So it's fun. I'm having a blast. I hope you're having fun doing this.
I am. I enjoy it. I wouldn't do it.
I know that.
All right,
man. I'll see you later.
See you next week.
All right. That's going to wrap it up for today. Sonny just hung up. Good time. So much history and everything that Sonny did with the Osborne brothers back in those days. And he is. He's the most modest man in the world. And I always need to pull stuff out of him, as everybody does. It's not me. I'm not trying to talk about me. But he just won't talk about what he accomplished, which was just monumental. In music, in American music, and bluegrass. So come back, enjoy it. Sonny will call back next week. Send me any questions that you have for him at the email address, which is available on the website, steve.martin@worldwidebluegrass.com, or send me a tweet at @unrealbluegrass. How easy could that be?